Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 261 of the Professional Book Nerds podcast presented by Overdrive. This is Adam by myself today. If you caught our most recent episode, you know that Jill is getting married. So by the time you hear this on Monday, at that point, I do believe she will have gotten married. So if you're listening to this, Jill, happy wedding. Good job. I don't know why you'd be listening to this, because you should be enjoying being married and all that jazz. For everyone else, if you're in the United States, happy Labor Day as this comes out on Monday, and happy Library Card Sign-Up Month, which is what September is. I'm going to assume the majority of people listening to the Professional Book Nerds podcast presented by a library company has a library card, but I know we have a lot of listeners all around the place. So if you frequently listen to us for book recommendations but don't frequent your library, first off, thanks for listening, obviously, but go get a library card. If you have a library card, go get one for a son or a daughter or a friend or someone who isn't currently using the library. You know, let's make that our like September little random act of kindness. Let's tell one person this month how awesome the library is. If every single one of us who listens to the podcast tells one person how great the library is, feel like we can make a really big impact on the amount of people that get library cards this month. So that's what I'm tasking you guys with. Just tell one person about the library and how wonderful ebooks are and all that jazz. Speaking of ebooks and the company that I work for, on September 18th, we'll be celebrating Read an Ebook Day, a holiday that I created about 5 years ago. It's turned into a big global event, which is really fun. If you go to readanebookday.com, you can see a really inspirational video about some of the stuff that we've heard people tell us about ebooks over the years. You can also find our hashtag there, which is ebooklove, all one word. And if you guys use that hashtag on September 18th, you have the ability to win a free device from Overdrive. We're going to give away a couple Kobo Aura 1s, thanks to our sister company, Kobo. And if you're a librarian listening in, let your library know to use that hashtag ebooklove, because we're also going to be giving away free content credit for our library and school partners. So just go online, post a picture on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, anywhere that you are on social media. Use that hashtag ebooklove. Post a picture of how you're celebrating the holiday, what your favorite, ebook is. Tell us why you love ebooks. We're going to pick a couple winners that way, which is really exciting. On that day, September 18th, I'm also going to be doing a Reddit AMA. So we're going to go to reddit.com, and then the thread is going to be our book. So I'll make sure that it's all over the place so you guys can find it. If you have any questions, obviously you guys have direct access to Jill and I, but if you have any like larger questions about Overdrive or Libby or digital reading or anything like that, definitely check out our Reddit AMA. We did one last year, and it was actually one of the most popular Reddit AMAs, I guess, ever at the time, which is really, really cool. I guess people have a lot of questions and interest, obviously, in digital reading. So a lot of fun stuff going on all September. We'll absolutely keep you up to speed. But just to recap, it's Library Card Sign-Up Month. Read an Ebook Day is September 18th. Check out our Reddit AMA and go to readanebookday.com for a whole bunch more fun information there. Okay, I think that's all the housekeeping. You can, of course, find us on Twitter and Instagram at ProBookNerds. Love everybody sending us emails at ProfessionalBookNerds@Overdrive.com. While I have you here, if you enjoy our podcast, I'm just going to give a little bit of a shout out to a couple other podcasts that I absolutely adore. Our friends at the Reading Glasses podcast did an incredible interview last week with Travis McElroy, one of the My Brother and Me trio, all about video game book tie-ins and his awesome book that him and his brothers and his father just came out with a couple weeks ago called There Be Gerblins. That's really awesome. And then our buddy Yin Chang at 88 Cups of Tea just routinely has absolutely phenomenal conversations with storytellers and authors, and it's really inspirational if you are a writer, an aspiring writer, or think that you can't be a writer. It'll change your mind. So just check out some of those lovely ladies. They're absolutely wonderful, and I adore all of them. And I know that sometimes they listen in. So hello, ladies. I enjoy all three of you and all of the conversations you guys have on a weekly basis. So speaking of wonderful ladies, transition, professional, I did it. Today's episode is an interview I did back at Book Expo America with Christina Daucher. She is the creator of the new book coming out this month called Vox, V-O-X. Vox is getting compared to The Handmaid's Tale. It's basically a world where women are only allowed to speak 100 words or less every single day, and the implications that that has on society and a whole bunch of other stuff. We really take a deep dive into it. She is phenomenally eloquent and just was so gracious with her time. She's actually done a lot of work now with us here at Overdrive and a couple other things that we're doing, which is wonderful. She has spent her life in linguistics and neurolinguistics, basically studying languages and all sorts of wonderful stuff. So we get into all of that in the conversation. I think you're really going to enjoy it. Definitely check out Vox. It's getting buzz all over the place. It was, I believe, on lists from Bustle and the New York Times and I think BuzzFeed and the BBC, all sorts of places. It's just, it's getting all sorts of buzz, and it's, and you'll see why if you check it out. So, okay, not going to keep you guys any longer. Thank you for letting me ramble on by myself here. Again, congratulations, Jill, if you're listening, to everyone else. Happy September. Library Card Sign-Up Month, Labor Day, Reading Ebook Day, so much going on. I hope you guys enjoy this conversation with Christina Dauker on the Professional Book Nerds Podcast. Hey everyone, it's Adam, and I am sitting here at Book Expo America, and I am excited to be sitting down with Christina Dauker, who has spent her life studying and teaching linguistics around the world. She writes incredible flash fiction, which I want to talk about a little bit later. And we're also going to get into her new book, Vox, which is receiving rave reviews as a very important book that I think people need to be reading this summer. We're going to be diving into the creation of that story and a whole bunch more. So first off, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be here, Adam.
And congratulations on the book. The idea of the story is amazing.
I hear that so much that I'm starting to believe it's really true.
So for people who might not have heard of the book yet or seen any of the buzz, can you maybe give them an introduction to the novel?
Yes, absolutely. Without giving too much away, we're living in a dystopia in this book, a very near future dystopia, in which a kind of ultra-conservative faction, a sort of silent majority, has become a lot less silent and a lot more of a majority, and started winding back the clock a little bit with respect to women's roles in the home and in society. And so we've got our protagonist, Dr. Jean McClellan, who is, or was, I should say, a cognitive linguist, a neurolinguist, at work on a cure for a certain type of speech loss, now finds herself in this new world, in this new society, limited with respect to the number of words she can say. And that limit is 100.
Yeah.
And they're monitored with a little bracelet-type device. So I hope that's enough to get you started and give you a taste.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think when people see like the blurbs about the story, the initial like shock point or the hook that draws people in is like, oh man, what would you do if you could only say 100 words in a day? But I was thinking about this, and I actually think I saw a story. I felt very vindicated because I think I saw an interview with you where you kind of said something that I was thinking. It's like when people think about this, they think about it as the story for themselves, like what would I do if I could only speak 100 words? But to me, like the real scary part about this is children and the generations of women beyond that, because they don't have, like, it's so important when you're younger to be learning. So I feel like that's the real horror story there.
Adam, I'm going to agree with you, actually. I think there are so many different ways that you can look at this book, that you can read this book, and different readers will take away different aspects, depending on what they find is salient, what really screams out to them. So just to put it in context, this 100 words, I know it sounds like a small number, but if we think about the fact that the average human speaks, the average adult speaks about 16,000 words a day, and we narrow that down to 100, now we're almost talking about nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes it quite frightening. And I do think you're right. There are not just limitations on this, on the speech, on the language that's used between adults, but also we've got in, like you said, I think the real horror is that these children are not being exposed to language by women, at least. And if we're considering that the women are now the primary caregivers, are the ones staying in the private sphere, and the men are out working in the public sphere, then these children are generally going to be cared for and spoken to, or not spoken to, by the females who are limited. So they're in, the input that they're getting is severely deprived, right? It's there's a paucity of input, and that's quite frightening. You're right. Yeah. I agree.
I told my wife the 16,000 number after I saw that, and she looked at me and she's like, Adam, I think yours is probably double that.
Yeah, well,
that's fair. I'm a bit long-winded.
Obviously, we're talking about averages. Everybody is different.
But the thing that I find interesting is positing this world, it wouldn't just be the young daughters that are affected, it'd be the young sons as well, because like you said, if the women are told to go back to the home and they're supposed to be the primary caregivers, like the whole thing just feels like it could crumble all of society. Like it's not going to become a matriarchy, it's going to become, or a patriarchy rather, it's going to be nothing.
Well, I think, and that we don't necessarily, we're not necessarily going quite there, but I think there's always that threat, right? So we've got a situation now where you're absolutely right. In future generations, if this if this restriction goes on, if this persists, then we are in fact looking at this complete degradation of language. And when you consider that language is the thing that makes us human,
right?
We've got two things that separate us from the animals. We've got big brains and the capacity for language.
Right.
There is no other species that has the capacity for language, which is, you know, not the same as communication.
Right.
You said you were a dog owner, so you know, you've got a dog. He'll communicate, or she'll communicate with you.
Right.
She'll wag her tail.
Mm-hmm.
She'll, you know, arf when she needs to go outside. She'll maybe roll over. But she does not have language.
Yeah.
So if you consider that the linguistic capacity of humans in future generations is going to get to a point where it's so degraded, then we kind of have to ask the question, what is it then that is continuing to make us human, to keep us human, right?
Yeah.
And that's the horror.
Yeah, it's more than just opposable thumbs,
right,
which is what we like to joke with my dogs.
And actually there are animals that have opposable
thumbs, yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Oh, and we always joke about our dogs. One of the two of them, the younger of the two, is very, he has these like human traits about them, and we like to joke with, it's like, if he could speak and open doors for himself, he wouldn't need us at all. It's so independent. It's very funny.
Right.
When people read this, I feel like I hope they get a little angry internally about the way that women are being treated, and I hope it continues to raise people to have kind of a call to action and sort of open their eyes about the things that are admittedly going on in our society today. And I know that novels take a long time to write, but did any of the things going on in kind of the world today affect your, maybe inspire you to want to write this?
Okay, so there are a couple of different questions there.
Yeah, I
which is fine. I'll take them one at a time.
Sure.
Remind me of the first part of that before we get to the current situation and the treatment of women in the book.
Right.
Absolutely. Well, there's one of the interesting things I think about, particularly about this protagonist, is that she's in a very sort of now I gotcha situation, in that she's lost her voice precisely because she didn't use it, right? She did not exercise it,
right?
And we're reminded of this constantly, not constantly, I'm not bombarding the reader with this,
not preaching,
but regularly, because Jean, the main character, she has these flashbacks. She's remembering this old friend of hers, this sort of, you know, ultra activist, you know, uber feminist, and who's constantly, the name is Jackie, the old friend, she's constantly kind of poking at Jean, saying, you know, you should go out, you should march, you should say something, you know, you need to realize that things could change. And and this main character, who's an academic, she's incredibly bright.
Right.
But she's in a bubble. And so the irony is that having not spoken, she ends up being voiceless.
Yeah.
So there's a sense in which it's not only about how badly women are being treated. It's also kind of a caution or a warning.
Mm-hmm.
To say, hey, you know, use it or lose it,
right?
Folks, right?
Yeah.
You know, you got this gift, and if you don't use it, it might go away.
Yeah.
So that's something that I really hope readers take away. Is, and it doesn't really matter what your politics are, what you think, what's important to you. The important thing is, if something is important to you, value it, treat it as if it's important.
Yeah.
And so that's the first part.
Absolutely, and I think something that interests me a lot about that is that when you look at society today, I think the majority of people that you'll see protesting and fighting for certain rights are people who are being affected by those things. Like me, as a straight white middle class male, like, to be honest, I've hit like the quote unquote jeans jackpot. Like there aren't a lot of things that are taken away from me, and so, but I think books like this are important to show people of all backgrounds and of all sexual orientations, and whether you're male, female, or otherwise, showing them, like, we all need to be fighting for equality and for women's rights and just rights of everybody. I think it's important. Well,
and also, we need to get out and vote.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely.
You know, if I won't quote numbers because numbers can be kind of boring in podcasts, but but all you have to do is go out to Google and pardon me, and look at the percentage of people who vote.
Yeah.
Who voted in presidential elections or local elections. And here again is the problem with Gene. Like, I don't have time to vote.
Yeah.
I gotta study. Uh-huh. Right? You know, I've got a PhD dissertation to write. I don't know, you let somebody else vote.
Yeah.
So I think that this is a really big message. Now, as far as your other question about what was on my mind when I wrote this,
yeah.
Well, I actually wrote it very quickly. I wrote it in 2 months.
Wow. That's amazing.
Well, you know, it is and it isn't. People keep getting shocked. But here's the thing, and I was just reminded of this. I saw a quote somewhere. It might have been in one of the show daily or something, or on Twitter. Everybody knows who Stephen King is,
mm-hmm.
right? I'm sure everybody's familiar with his excellent book on writing.
Yes.
You know, which is sort of half instruction manual, half memoir. It's really brilliant. And obviously this man is so prolific. The empirics speak for themselves. Here's what Stephen King says about writing a first draft. A first draft should take no more than 3 months. So it's interesting to me that everybody's so shocked
mm-hmm.
when I tell them that I wrote Vox very quickly, but in fact, this Stephen King quote is all over the place.
Yeah.
Right? So there is this, you know, this writing fast. Obviously, I'm very lucky in that I write full time,
mm-hmm.
and so I do have the time
sure.
to devote to that. But I also had an idea of a doomsday scenario, which is where I got the concept of aphasia. I didn't come up with the concept of aphasia, obviously, but I came up with the concept of language scrambling.
Yeah.
Right. And rendering people sort of speechless in a kind of a doomsday sort of mm-hmm. way. So I had that, and then I also had a short story that I'd written,
mm-hmm.
and that, so the writing came very easily. As to why I was so kind of anxious to get it done, well, one, it was just a delight to write this.
Uh-huh.
And this, remember, this really happened, this writing happened before the Me Too movement was truly out there
right.
and had kind of exploded, so that wasn't on my radar. But since I work with a very bare bones outline, I have to, and I write linearly, I have to write in order to know what's going to happen next, in order mm-hmm. to know how I'm going to get from this scene to that scene,
sure.
or this very salient point where I need to be
uh-huh.
to the next turn or the next twist or the next major mm-hmm. event. And so there were times when I just I'm almost part of the audience. I'm almost like the reading audience when I'm writing. Like, ooh, what's going to happen now? And there are other authors who are like that. I think Lee Child has said things like that. And there were also a few scenes where, particularly involving Jean's daughter, Sonia, who's only 6 years old and is now living in this world, which is the only world she knows, this world where she is not supposed to talk. She gets prizes at school if she doesn't speak.
Yeah.
Right? Lowest number of words, here, have an ice cream, little girl.
It's crazy.
It is actually. I mean, I get chills thinking about it. So there are times in which this young girl, Sonia, is in either, I think, a psychologically or a physically dangerous situation.
Oh, yeah.
And so writing those scenes was just, I could not type fast enough. I'm sort of living in them, right?
It's interesting that you're talking about that. From a craft standpoint, I know that a lot of people will give themselves like a word count or an hour amount of time that they're going to spend. But one of my favorite writing quotes that I believe it was Hemingway talked about, he would end off on the middle of a sentence, like not even in the middle of a paragraph, like in the middle of a sentence. So when he sat down the next day, he knew where to pick up from. So because you're talking about getting from point A to point B and there being these harrowing scenes that you're writing and kind of learning them as you go. So from a writing standpoint, were you being like, okay, I need to get to what many people would think of like as an end of chapter cliffhanger, or were you purposely leaving yourself like an exciting something to sink your teeth into in the morning?
I see what you mean. You know, I do both, and I know that quote. I'd forgotten, or not that anecdote. I'd forgotten that it was attributable to Hemingway.
I may be wrong.
No,
I just
I
feel
you're,
like
you're
it's
probably it, right. Yeah. I mean, everything's attributable to
mostly,
Hemingway, right?
Yeah.
And either apocryphally or really. So you know, when in doubt, yes, Hemingway said
Hemingway
it.
Said it. I'm
and,
pretty sure.
You know, and people will believe you.
Yeah.
And you'll probably be right. So. There are times when I will stop in mid-scene because, you know, I do have to do other things like cook dinner, you know, go for a walk, get some exercise, go grocery shopping.
Sure.
I have a very patient husband, but I still feel a little bit horrible if I go, oh, right, we've got to just do something else again for dinner because I don't have a clue. So I do break off intentionally. And sometimes I remind myself of that breaking off in mid-thought or in mid-paragraph or in mid-sentence just so I can pick that back up. I don't have to start afresh the next time I sit down. However, if a scene is really juicy, and by juicy I mean either horrific or in the case of a few sex scenes with my Italian sort of hero in Vox. Well, those were just so fun to write.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I always loved Italian men when I was young.
Uh-huh.
And so I, you know, when I dreamed up Lorenzo, okay, yeah. This is great.
Basically molding him out of mental clay sort of a thing. It makes me really excited to hear that though, because I feel like I've talked to a number of authors who will tell me, they'll write up a story and they'll be like, admittedly, this was very hard for me to write for whatever reason, and that doesn't make the book any less interesting or less incredible, but to me, if an author is as excited as you are about a story, you exude this excitement about the book, and it makes other people want to read it even more and be like, okay, well, if she couldn't wait to write these stories, I can't wait to read them.
That's a lovely thing to say, first, but and I am excited about it. You know, I go back sometimes, and I've done this with my flash fiction as well, and I do it with Vox. I'll go back and I'll read a little paragraph. There are times in which I really forget what space I was in when I was writing a piece of fiction, either whether it's short or whether it's long. And so I go back, and I think I've done this, maybe we all do, to a certain extent. Oh my goodness. I did okay there, didn't I? Was that really me? How did I do that? Can I do it again? So it's fun to kind of experience that. And I was so excited about this story. I had so much fun with it. I mean, I know that seems shocking because, see what I did there? Gotta read the book to find out what I mean by that. It seems shocking to say that I enjoyed myself while I'm writing what is effectively a horror story. But I am a fan of dark things.
We mentioned Stephen King, so
I think I stole a Stephen King book from one of my uncle's bookshelves when I was 13. I think it was Salem's Lot. And like, wow. You know, first of all, it had vampires in it.
Yes.
Which is, like, great. I mean, anything. I'll read anything with vampires in it.
Well, and
anything.
his version of vampires in Salem's Lot, I think, might be my favorite.
Oh, it's a lot of fun. So I do enjoy writing these things that terrify people, and I terrified myself when I was writing Box. I certainly terrified my characters. I think that there are instances where Jean, the protagonist, is, on the one hand, she is irate that here she is, this brilliant scientist, reduced to not being able to keep up her work, which was curing a certain type of language loss. But also, she's living in fear for this little six-year-old girl of hers, right? I mean, so there was so much anger there. But I don't know, there's something about that anger and that fear that made it really, really, I would say, enjoyable, because you didn't feel like you were forcing anything. It was coming out naturally.
So you write flash fiction, and people who might not be familiar, flash fiction is incredibly short stories, like sometimes actually and as few as 100 words or less, much like what they're allowed to speak in Box. And I love reading flash fiction. I admittedly, if I need a break while I'm at work, I will go find some flash fiction, because it's like little like snacks of stories where you can just kind of sink your teeth into them for a few seconds, a few minutes. But because of that, as an author who writes flash fiction, you have to craft a story that will grab someone and make them think, and you have to do it in a paragraph. And so did all of your experience with that help with writing a long-form story, but a long-form story that is very gripping and immediate?
Pardon. That's an excellent question. I did actually write a longer work before I started writing flash fiction. It's a completely different novel about 3.5 years ago. And it also featured a linguist, but very different from Vox. And they say generally you should take a break from writing something, you know, once it's out on submission, you should do something different. So I started writing flash. I really got into it. I was, I found a fantastic community of flash fiction writers on Twitter. I mean, these people have been, I wish I could name all of them, because they have all been so good to me. And we've been good to each other.
Right.
We read each other's work, we feed off of each other's work, we lift each other up when we've been rejected, and so on, and celebrate each other's successes. So I did write a lot of flash. And I think one of the things that I noticed when I was reading other books is that in some cases, you can pick up a novel and you read a scene and it almost stands on its own, right? Some authors do this, and they're very, very good at it. And I like that. I think that it gives the reader a little bit of a break, maybe, from this, now this is happening, this is happening, this is happening. You can pull people into the scene. And I actually tried that when I was writing Box. Normally, I write very linearly. Word one to the end, unless I have an epiphany and I go, okay, I've got to write this scene now.
Right.
But when before I even started writing that first word, I did just pick out some scenes that I wanted to write. So I imagined, for instance, early on in the book, there's a scene where Jean and her husband are in bed together. And they're, you know, getting down to business. And it's really an odd experience. There's no problem here. There's no issue of I don't want to or anything like that. They're married. They're happily married. But there was this weirdness of making love to someone who you've been with for, almost 20 years. And not even really being able to say his name or say, I love you, or say, oh, honey, that feels so good. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems weird. I mean, can you imagine? Now, I mean, I guess, people can make love in all kinds of different ways.
Right.
But I guess that if you just absolutely can't say anything, that would be odd. And so I put Gene in this position, and I wrote it as a piece of flash fiction. It's, not too short. It's about 1,000 words. And in fact, it worked so well as a standalone scene that with just one tiny tweak, I was able to use that. I was able to submit it to a flash contest, and I won first prize.
That's amazing,
So it was really delightful to do that. So there's an example of how you can kind of use the ability to, or this practiced craft of writing something very condensed and sometimes lyrical.
Yeah.
And insert it into an otherwise commercial novel.
Yeah.
And I think it really worked well. So I did it with a couple of other scenes, which I don't recall off the top of my head. But the silent sex one was actually my favorite.
To me, Shirley Jackson's We Have Always Lived in the Castle, which is it's like a flawless piece of writing. But
Shirley Jackson is a goddess.
Exactly. So, yeah. But I just feel like that, the kind of the same thing with, you could take each individual scene from that. And it's like the when she's first walking through the streets, and every single person is either staring at her and giving these dirty looks, or internally she thinks they all are. And then like that entire scene, I could take that and like it gives, like I'm getting chills when I was talking about the same thing with like when you find out, spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't read this, like when you find out that she's the one who kind of murdered all of her family, like that could, it, all of those pieces. And you're absolutely right, like you can remember a novel and a story for the story that it tells, but there are so many examples of books out there that you'll say, so-and-so wrote a great story, but there was just one scene.
Absolutely. I absolutely. And it might not be a scene that really takes the whole novel and tells the novel's story. It might just be one pullout.
Right.
That has, out of context, you could tell somebody about it and they might not even recognize what novel it's from.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's nice, and it's also very, very refreshing to finish writing something long and then relax and go back to flash fiction because when you're involved in a longer work, you're in a single genre, you're the same characters, same voice, especially if you're writing in first person POV with a single narrator, and wow, what a what a delight it is to end that and then go write about an old man sitting on a porch in southern Georgia with this like nagging wife, and wow, his dog saves the day by turning into a vampire and getting rid of her. This is like what a it's so different. And it's fun, you can experiment.
There's one more question I want to ask you about the book, because while people are reading it, I want them to realize that some of this came from the truth. So we don't get into specifically in the book, so people will find out, but there is a religious movement that is kind of leading the country in the book, and I think I saw that's sort of based off an extreme group in America, correct?
Yes.
Can you talk about a little bit about I just want people while they're reading the story to realize this, there are people out there who have these sorts of beliefs, and that part, I think I saw you talking about it, and it just fascinated me to know that there are people out there who have beliefs very, like, somewhat adjacent to what happens in Vox.
Absolutely. Well, so this is very true. The Pure movement in Vox, which is this movement that has come into power, they've got a lot of support, they've got a lot of money, they've got a lot of influence over a sort of a lame duck president who just effectively got elected because of this movement. Mm-hmm. So I based this on a mid 19th century movement known as the culture of domesticity, right? That existed here in the US and in the UK, and also shortened to the cult of domesticity, called a few other things. And so if you look back at, you know, religious tracts or women's magazines or lots of things back into, you know, the middle of the 1800s, you'll find that it was often very encouraged for women to stay in the private sphere, that is the home, and for men to stay in the public sphere. And women were expected to be virginal, pious, submissive to their husbands, caretakers, feminine, and so on. This was very encouraged. Well, obviously not every woman agreed. There were women, who were at the forefront of this. This was not a movement of men who were saying, okay, women, this is how you're going to behave. This was society's idea of this kind of woman, of the this domestic goddess. Now, of course, not all women agreed with this.
Right.
So, you know, we had people like Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley and quite a few others who were very outspoken. And we found that different movements, the little, you know, pushing back movements occurred. Sometimes out of necessity, when men went off to fight in the Civil War, women had to start doing a little bit more work, right? And then, of course, men came back, so on and so forth. And we can go on forward. We can, you know, we certainly know this happened in World War II. That, you know, women were being employed in factories, right, all the time. What happened to their jobs when the men came back home, or Johnny marched back home? If you want to go with the song, well, they went back to the home, and we were back in the Then we were in the 1950s. Another culture of domesticity,
right?
Yeah. Look at the television shows. Uh-huh. Look at Leave It to Beaver and Father Knows Best. Look at the title of the television shows, yeah. Father Knows Best. So there was this back and forth, right? You know, culture of domesticity, and then there were, you know, new women and feminine, and, you know, an early sort of feminism and the flappers in the 20s. And then finally in the 60s, I think, women said, okay, enough. We're done. Right? We're just done. And I think that's when the culture of domesticity really ended for good. So one of the things that Vox explores is, could this happen again?
Right.
Could we go back? Could we have another resurgence of the culture of domesticity? And in fact, there are some organizations that exist today which are very fundamentalist, they have very literal interpretations of certain books and ideas. And one of them, in fact, is women should be in the home, men should be at work. This is they have different places.
Right.
Women should be feminine and submissive and pious and all of that. There are people, obviously, who believe all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. But yes, it's true that there are people who support this kind of thing. Are they a majority? I don't think so.
Yeah.
But in Vox, they become one. Yeah. And so that is the story, right? That's
what happens. So towards the end of our podcast, we like to do what I call the Nerd 9, because I like alliteration. They're 9 lighthearted questions. They are not rapid fire, because we get on tangents all the time, so we've stopped calling them rapid fire. Everyone used to yell at us and say, please stop saying those words. It's not rapid fire. So the first one is, do you remember the last book you finished reading?
Last book I finished reading. Yes.
Or it could be a book you're currently reading.
It was, oh, great, yes, I'm reading, shoot, I'm sorry, I just had a complete mental, like, breakdown. I'm currently reading The Power.
Yeah, and you get bonus points because she literally, in real time, opened up the Overdrive app to take a look at that, so I'm just saying that made me very...
I get bonus points.
Bonus points for
brilliant.
That. Do you have a favorite place to read?
Well, since I listen to audiobooks a lot, mm-hmm. my favorite place to read is taking a really long walk around my city, like an urban hike.
Do you remember the book that made you kind of fall in love with reading, or maybe the book that made you want to be a writer?
Oh, fall in love with reading, Charlotte's Web, probably.
Yeah.
And, you know, an oldie but a goodie, and that was a long time ago. The book that made me want to be a writer is... anything that Stephen King ever wrote.
Yeah.
In fact, I am the sole matriculant in the Read Every Word by Stephen King DIY MFA program, just so
that's
you know my
incredible.
Academic background.
Yeah. When you go to ALA in a couple of weeks, I'm going to have to, you have to stop by our booth because Jill, my co-host, you and her are very much like-minded. What's one place you'd like to travel that you have not yet been to?
Oh, Thailand.
Yeah, that's a good one. Do you have a favorite holiday to celebrate?
Favorite holiday to celebrate? Oh, Arbor Day.
Nice.
Arbor Day. You know, it's about trees. You don't have to worry about gifts. You don't have to make any food. You can just go sit under a tree and
nature.
Say, hi.
Yeah.
Nice going, tree.
Are you a coffee person or a tea person?
Coffee. Black. No sugar.
Yeah, you and me.
No
well, plus, do you still live in Italy?
No, I don't live in Italy. I just spend a lot of time.
Oh, okay.
In,
I was gonna say,
Italy,
I feel like
so
you
coffee.
Have access to no, very good coffee.
I just, well, yes, I do because there are no Starbucks in Italy.
Yeah.
Not that Starbucks is bad. It's just that there aren't any in Italy yet, which is interesting. However, I do enjoy a caffè latte. So
yes.
My coffee either has to be absolutely black with nothing in it, or it has to be. Like half hot milk, half coffee, and a ton of sugar.
Perfect.
It's my Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde coffee thing.
Are you a cat person or a dog person?
Both.
That's
I've had both. I like cats that act like dogs and dogs that act like cats.
You're the second person in a row who has told me that. That's amazing. Do you have a favorite food? Someone once told me mine was coffee, actually. This is the amount of it I drink.
Really good French fries will be just fine.
Are you a waffle or a crinkle cut? This is not part of our normal nine, but I'm interested in a French fry take.
No, it's got to be like good French fries, preferably with those potatoes that you can only find in Belgium, right? Or in the Netherlands.
So they'd be frites.
They would be frites. Yeah, exactly.
And then last one of these, if you could have dinner with one person alive or dead, who would you pick?
You know, I actually have a blog post called My Dead Person's Dinner Party that I've taken it down now because I thought it was too cheesy. But, you know, I had 6 people. Okay, dinner with one person dead or alive.
If you have 6, you can say 6. I'm okay with this. If you want to tell people who the 6 are.
Oh, I don't know whether I remember.
Oh, it's
but,
okay.
Okay, I've got Carl Sagan, I've got Stephen King, Roald Dahl, Ayn Rand, and...
really good
someone list. Else I, no I actually invited an evil person because I wanted to have like all the other people you know beat the crap out of him so like you know Genghis Khan you know somebody like really bad
absolutely
that, I'm just
that's
teasing
okay.
about that
that's great. Oh, so last question for you, what do you hope readers take away from Reading Box?
I hope that because this is a book about a number of things about Jean's inability to speak, possibly because she didn't speak up when she could. I hope that resonates with readers. And I also hope that looking at not only Jean's inability to speak, but also the younger, the young daughters, Sonia's, the 6-year-old daughters, this unfortunate, terrifying circumstance that she's in, I hope it makes people really, the book makes people think about how vital language is to us and how little we think about it. I want to leave you with one tiny linguistic tidbit. This is true. Barring any interference or any kind of cool pathologies, every single child of 3 or 4 years old will speak his or her native language perfectly.
That's amazing.
Right? Grammatically perfectly.
Yeah.
They really will. They know that language. And because this is something that happens without any schooling, without any formal education, without reading, we don't even think about it. We take it for granted. So I would be the happiest linguist or ex-linguist in the world if upon reading Box, you sit back and you go, this is amazing that I can speak and think this language because it's so complicated. We can't even get computers to do it perfectly, but any 4-year-old can. So if you think about that, you'll have made my day.
That's perfect. Christina, I could watch you give a masterclass on linguistics and writing and all of this. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, I'm just delighted. That's very flattering, and I had a wonderful time.
Thank you.
Readers can sample and borrow the titles mentioned in today's episode from Overdrive.com, and our library friends can add these titles to their collections and marketplace.
History is complicated. The story of human progress is long, messy, and riddled with controversies big and small. On Conflicted, we dive headfirst into history's most infamous events and contentious figures. We try and untangle the good from the bad, the fact from the fiction, and the monsters from the misunderstood. Was Genghis Khan a murderous butcher or a civic pioneer? Did the Allied powers go too far in firebombing the German city of Dresden at the twilight of World War II? And how did the Marquis de Sade acquire such a sinister reputation? And was any of it true? These are just a few of the tough questions we wrestle with and investigate on Conflicted. So if you love history or just enjoy a good story, please join me, your host, Zach Cornwell, for a fascinating new topic each and every month. Conflicted, a history podcast, is available on Spotify, Apple, or wherever else you get your podcasts. I hope to see you soon.